WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. They're known as the world's greatest rock and roll band, and whether or not you think their music is still worthy of the title, there's no denying the importance of the Rolling Stones. They've been recording since 1963, and their longevity is unprecedented. Bassist Bill Wyman is the member of the band that calls the least attention to himself on stage. And offstage, he's had the reputation as the Quiet Stone. But now he's written a biography of the band called Stone Alone. The book takes the Stones' story through the 1960s. In 1964, the Stones had their first single on the U.S. charts. It was Tell Me.
I want you back again. I want your love again.
What have you done to keep track and to remember what has happened over the years?
Well, I've been writing diaries since I was a child, and unfortunately, when I did my military service, being the only one that did in the Stones, my mother threw all my old diaries away when I was a little boy, so I was a bit disappointed about that. But I kept a diary ever since then, like from before I joined the Stones, right the way through to the present day, which is very valuable.
Do you ever feel that you're the only one of the Stones with enough of a memory to keep everything straight because you were straight?
Well, that's a good way of putting it. Keith Richard does have quite a good memory, actually, believe it or not. The others aren't very good at memorizing anything.
In your book, you write that you've stayed away from drugs over the year, apart from some pill popping and occasional joints in the mid-60s. Why did you always steer clear of drugs?
I just like reality. I quite enjoy my life as it is, and what's happening, my private life as well, and I've never really thought I needed that sort of escapism. And drugs, you know, drugs are such a problem. They're a problem to get access to them, as I've seen from other people, and they just cause so many problems within yourself and your personal friends and family and things like that. And I was always feeling very responsible, particularly for bringing my child up, since I was divorced from the ages of about 4 on my own. And I always felt very responsible to go back to him and be a normal father if I could, which was saying something in this band.
Brian had once described you as the Rolling Stone that nobody ever knew. Did you see yourself as different from the rest of the Stones in any way?
Well, I was, for the same reasons. I felt responsible to go home after shows instead of hanging out in clubs at night. I do the reverse now, probably, because my son's grown up. But and Charlie did as well. You see, he got married in 64, so we were both married and stable, and we would go back to our families after concerts and after a day's work, whereas the others would just hang out with friends and get up to all kinds of mischiefs.
And now?
Well, it's the other way around now. I think they all stay at home with their friends, and I get up to all the mischief.
Uh-huh. Bill Wyman is my guest, Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones, and his new book is called Stone Alone. How did you first meet up with the Rolling Stones, with the other members of the band, and start playing with them?
I had a band in South London, which I'd been playing in for about 2 years. It was my band. And my drummer answered an ad for a drummer for a small blues group in London called the Rolling Stones. R-O-L-L-I-N apostrophe Stones, which was an assortment of musicians that got together and actually played 2 or maybe 3 very small gigs per month. in the period of mid-62 to the end of 62. And he filled the drum chair. It was always vacant. There were always people coming and going. It was Brian and Ian Stewart, the keyboard player, who formed the band, started it, and Mick and Keith later joined with a few other people, and people came and went. And he joined the band, my drummer, and played on and off with them for about 4 or 5 months, probably 10 or 12 shows or something, for very small jazz things and that. There was no other places to play in those days. And one day he came to me at the end of November or early December 62 and said, look, they don't have a bass player. Why don't you come up and come to a rehearsal? So I went up there and met everybody. That's the way it happened.
You didn't like the blues as much as the other members of the group?
There's nothing to do with liking. I'd never heard it. In those days, blues was not played in on the radio. There were no records to buy that had blues in them. They were all American, they were all imports. And they were collected by mainly jazz people who sent away for records. And as I did for records like Chuck Berry and people like that, I would write to America for them because they were not released in England. Mick had done it, which I was not aware of at the time. He'd done it about the same time as I had, writing off to America for records. There was no availability for that kind of music unless you knew various students of jazz and people that hung out in clubs in London, which I didn't go to in those days, and you met up with people who might have a Muddy Waters single or a Little Walter EP or something like that. Or they had tapes. People like Long John Baldry and those kind of people had various tapes and records which it got from import shops. So it wasn't that I didn't like the blues, it's I didn't know them. I'd never heard it. But when they first introduced me to it, and I was about to play it, I found it quite interesting, and I started to make a blues collection.
How did the Stones start moving away from blues, more toward original material and more toward rock and roll?
When Mick and Keith started coming up with good original songs, I think. We were still doing odd cover versions of things, but that was mainly soul music, early soul music and R&B. The likes of Otis Redding before he was well known, Solomon Burke, Sam Cooke, people like that. And then they started writing really good songs, and it did become more rock and roll because we were on the road all the time. If we weren't touring America, it was Europe or Australia, England, Scandinavia, and the fans really liked up-tempo music on stage. That's what it really came down to. Whereas in the club's earlier days, you could play very slow songs, it was all right.
The image of the Stones early on was the scruffy, dirty, bad boy band. How much of that was image that was actually planned, and how much of that was just the way you were at the time?
It's totally the way we were, but we weren't scruffy, dirty, and smelly and all that, but people just thought we were, because people didn't look like that in those days. They were very well dressed, smart suits, ties, clean shirts. We didn't dress like that. We didn't go on stage with uniforms. It wasn't an important part of the music, we didn't think. The same as other sort of small incidental things, like not smiling when they poked a camera at you. We didn't see why you had to give a big beaming smile when as soon as somebody pointed a lens at you. They were very, very small and unimportant things, but at the time they were thought of as very rebellious and anti-establishment and just being awkward, I suppose.
In the 1960s, when you started touring around the world, you were always really mobbed at concerts by, you know, teenagers who wanted to be near the band and touch the members of the band, or do more than that if they could. Was it ever frightening to be mobbed like that? Were you ever scared?
Oh, there were certain incidences where it was very dangerous, yeah, but you kind of carried it off as a bit of a joke, really. There were panicky moments when you thought cars were going to, the roof of the car was going to come in with people on top of you and all that, and you were suffocated. You couldn't open the windows, and there was faces pressed and bodies against the car in all directions. You couldn't see where the car was going, so you couldn't drive. And you got rescued by the police. There were quite frightening times like that, but it was so over so quickly that it always became a bit of a laugh. And I remember something that's on film from Ireland in 1965, where we're being attacked on stage and all kinds of mayhem going on, and you see at the last moment one of the guys from the record company trying to drag Brian and Keith away off the stage to escape, and Brian's laughing his head off, and it was a bit like that. We'd go in, jump in the car and drive away, and we'd be absolutely on the floor laughing about what had happened. It was so quick, you know, that you didn't realise the real danger until it was all over.
Brian Jones was one of the main forces behind the Rolling Stones in the first part of the band's life, and then he died in an accident. What have you been able to find out about the cause of his death? How much of it was due to health problems he was suffering? How much of it was because of drugs?
I think it was a combination of all three, actually. I think over the period of the last few years of his life, he was doing a lot of popping all kinds of pills and things. He used to take a lot of downers, you know, to sleep in pills and then stay awake on them, which makes people very kind of disoriented, a bit like very drunk. And he was drinking quite a lot as well. He'd consume 1-2 bottles of brandy a day and things like that. So the mixture of drugs and alcohol for a start wasn't very good. And then he was taking other drugs, you know, taking dope and that. But I don't think he ever was involved in heroin or cocaine, as far as I remember. Definitely not heroin. And he did have he was very unhealthy. He had a health problem. He had asthma very badly. And I've learned since in researching this book that he had it was quite possible that he had an epileptic problem as well, which the band weren't aware of, and I don't know whether Brian was aware of. And I think the combination of all those caused his death. I think it's quite likely that he suffered an epileptic fit in the swimming pool when he was under the influence of drinking alcohol, and that would explain everything very simply.
When he died, it was already agreed that he was going to leave the band.
He'd already left
the band. But what impact did it have on the personal lives of everybody in the group to see someone who they'd been close to die?
Well, obviously it was a great blow to us, and everybody was extremely upset about it. He'd left the band a month before. He was starting to put together the semblances of a new band, and he was very enthusiastic and excited about it. And he was a little bit of a changed person, really. It was the calm before the storm. And then suddenly it happened, you know, when you least expected it. And we were doing a concert at Hyde Park in front of almost 500,000 people 3 days later. And we had the terrible decision of whether to continue with the concert or whether to give it up. We decided to go ahead, but everybody was very upset about it. It's probably why, although the concert was a great event, the band didn't play that wonderfully at the time. You know, it was a bit, I think our thoughts were elsewhere. It was a very sad moment, you know, because we all knew him for years, and we still thought of him as a Rolling Stone, really.
I want to ask you about the Altamont Festival, and this was the festival in 1969 where someone was stabbed to death by one of the Hell's Angels guards at the concert, and the Rolling Stones were performing on stage at the time that the murder took place. I'm wondering what it looked like from your perspective, what you knew was happening in the audience.
It was quite frightening, actually, because it was a situation where we had no control over whatsoever. And the security, as it was Hell's Angels, who were quite vicious and violent with the audience in the front, a bit more violent than they need to have been, and involved in unnecessary beating up of people and things. There was very little you could do. If you stop... In those situations, and in riot situations, or any kinds of disturbances, whether they're friendly or not, if you stop playing the music, it tends to get worse, and we've often found that. So we continued to play as much as we possibly could throughout all those disturbances, repeatedly stopping and saying, look, let's call it, let's be good, you know, let's be friends, don't fight, and try to keep the thing going to its end. And this, I remember that guy, Meredith, in a green suit, a black guy in a green suit. He was very near to me where I was standing on the stage. He was about probably eight or 10 feet away from where I was in front of me. And I remember seeing him there on quite a few occasions because he did stand out in the crowd with this bright green suit on. I didn't actually see, I just saw a disturbance in the crowd, as I'd seen many many disturbances during the concert of the crowd opening up and angels going in there flaying people with pool cues and pool sticks. And it was like another one of those disturbances. You'd see dust rising and the crowd open up and something go on, and then it'd cool down again, and it went on and on all the time like that. That's all I can recall of it. And it was getting very late and very dark and cold, and it was just a very bad atmosphere.
During part of the disturbances at Altamont, the Stones were playing Sympathy for the Devil. And I think some people felt that that was, in a way, kind of stirring things up in the crowd, that it was like a bad choice of songs to perform given what was happening. What do you think?
Well, we've performed it ever since on many tours and never had a problem. And those disturbances started from the moment we were on stage. That was just, I think that's, we did all kinds of songs on that show where there were fighting and trouble going. Sympathy for the Devil was just one of the songs we performed. Under My Thumb it was happening. That's got nothing to do with disturbing people or a disturbing song. I think they've got to look at the film to see what we were actually performing, and that was just one of many songs where there was fighting going on.
Bill Wyman, the bass player for the Rolling Stones, is my guest, and he's written a new memoir called Stone Alone. Do you think it's possible to have a quote, normal life with the kind of money and attention that are lavished on rock stars? I guess what I'm really asking is...
My life is very normal.
Uh-huh. I guess I'm not asking so much about you as about, say, Mick Jagger, who's more of, like, the star of the band. I don't know. It seems to me at a certain level, an almost, like, ego deformity seems to to set in with a lot of, like, star performers in every field. And you've been both... You've been an almost like participant observer in a way. Do you know what I mean? It's like the quieter member
the only
of the
person,
band.
The only person in this band that's ever been regarded as a jet setter or a glamour situation, like you've been saying, is probably Mick, who loves to do that. He loves to be out there with society people and hang out with film stars and jet from one place to the other and go to lavish parties and things. The rest of the band don't do that. You don't get Charlie going to the place like that. Keith doesn't. Keith's very, very gypsy-fied, piratey, you know, and so is Ronnie Wood. Charlie and I are very, very laid-back family men. We don't do those things. You know, I think that's... America's always focused a tremendous amount of attention on Mick, and it's the only place in the world where the Stones were ever... talked about as Mick Jagger and the Rolling Stones. It was never like that anywhere else, and it still isn't. It's the Rolling Stones. And yes, Mick is probably the greatest performer that there's been in rock and roll. And he's a wonderful performer. He's a wonderful dancer. He's a great singer. And we're very proud of having him at the front of us. But that's the image that's been given the Stones through Mick's behavior, not through the rest of the members of the band.
The Steel Wheels tour of was over a year ago. Is that mm-hmm. Do I have a date right? Yeah, it was one of these like zillions of dollars tours that had backing from was it Budweiser who backed the tour?
Yes,
as a commercial sponsor. And I think a lot of people saw this as an example of what rock tours had become: very lavish, expensive productions that had a lot in common with the kind of show business that rock had in its early days rebelled against.
Yes.
And I wonder if you ever think it's gotten too much, you know, too show busy, too expensive, where the music itself kind of gets lost and the values of rock and roll get lost.
But if it's done right, the music doesn't get lost. It just embellishes the music, as it did with our concerts, I believe. The Stones always... tried to have when we went on tour, always tried to have the best stage we could possibly have made, the best lighting, the best sound system. It was always the best attempt, and it cost the most money. And over the years, that's probably why the Stones were never as wealthy as many bands that were riding alongside them at various times in their career, because the Stones spent the majority of their earning money of a tour on the production. And it did become a big production, of course it did, but it had to, because we tried playing small gigs at various times on tours, and we were always criticised because playing a small theatre in New York. All we got was complaints from all the people that didn't go, saying they couldn't buy tickets because it was too small. Why don't we play a bigger place? So you end up playing the bigger places, and then the people, other people complain, saying they'd like to see us in a small environment. You can't win, really. And with the demand for tickets of over the last 10 or 12 years for the Stones, both in 81 and 89 were the two last big tours, both of them, the only places you could play were big stadiums because of the ticket demands.
You're 53 years old now, is that right?
No, I just turned 54.
54. You know, it's always the Rolling Stones that people point to when they talk about how, you know, rock performers are getting older, and the music has gotten older, and people always say, you know, how old can you be and still play rock and roll? I think the Rolling Stones have helped resolve that question, you know, that rock and roll is no longer just a teenage music. And you could probably...
Well, the only reason it was a teenage music in the first place was because the actual format of the music didn't start until the mid-50s in America and a bit later in England, and there was nobody that got old enough to play it older, because you only lived for 2 or 3 years in the business then. So you never had your elder statesman of that music, but you look at all other music, country music, jazz, classical, anything, you've got very old people playing it, because the music's been around a long time, and the people that started have become old. Now the Stones have become old, and we're still playing it, and we're still proving that it can be done at our age. And a lot of very young people resent that for some reason.
The press in America and England have been writing about your marriage to a woman who's 33 years younger than you. Were you concerned when you married her that this would be a big press subject? I mean, is it something you really try to keep hidden?
No, I read about Picasso, and I realized that Picasso's marriage difference between him and his wife was even greater than mine. So I thought, if he can get away with it, so can I, you know. And he lived to be 94, so he was a good person to look on as an opinion.
How is Ron Wood? He was just hit by a car and broke.
Yeah, I heard that yesterday, and I just saw it in the newspapers today. I haven't been in touch with him yet. But apparently he's quite comfortable and much better, and I think he did quite a brave thing, although they said it was a bit foolish of him. He ran out and tried to stop cars from crashing into the car where his wife and his two children were. I thought he was very brave.
Bill Wyman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Bill Wyman is the bass player for the Rolling Stones. His new memoir is called Stone Alone.